say the game is getting old. Monday morning and your coffee's cold. Life is not what you want.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Direction. My name's Jay Izzo, and oh, man, another great show. This is one of those shows that just shakes me to my core. Fabulous book written by Andres Lars, Jeff Cochran, and Dr. Sean Diggin. Persuade. Oh, the four-step process to influence people and decisions. Folks, let's be honest here. So many of you are CEOs and you're founders of businesses. I've got sales professionals from all over the world that listen into this show as well. And here's the thing. You're always saying to me that the companies that I work for as a behavioral strategist, the companies that I go into, you say the same thing. We've got to improve ourselves. I don't know what's wrong with our sales team. We've got to improve. They don't seem to be able to close the deal. Or they're not closing enough deals is the other one I get, right? Well, maybe part of the problem is because they're not as educated as we'd like to believe when it comes to persuasion and influence. And there's a process to this psychologically that you have to follow to be more successful. It's in this book. It is laid out so beautifully. I just shared the pyramid with the real estate sales team yesterday. I shared this pyramid. I put it up on the whiteboard. I rolled it out there for everybody to see. And we talked through it. We walked through it. And everybody went, oh, yeah. This book, Persuade, and Andres Lars is going to help you today. Absolutely fabulous book. I love this book. I loved every second of it. I read through every page, literally every single page. It was so good. I highly suggest wherever it's sold, get yourself a copy. Andres, is this in audio yet or no?
It is. I think recently it went to audio. So, yeah.
Okay.
And for a fun fact, it's also in German. So if you'd like to read it in German, you can do that too.
So if you sprechen Sie Deutsch, okay, for those out there, and I have a number of people in Germany who listen to the show. I cover all of Germany. And so folks in Germany, you could find this in your native tongue. Let me introduce you to Andres Lars. He's fantastic. He's been a managing partner and CEO of Shapiro Negotiations Institute since 2017. Prior to this role, Andres served various roles, including Chief Innovation Officer, where he led the company's development of technology and content. For over a decade, Andres has advised professional sports teams in the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, National Hockey League, on contract negotiations, trades, and other critical negotiations. He's been featured in publications, including Harvard Business Review, Forbes, CNBC, Entrepreneur, Sports Business Journal. Andres guest lectures at conferences and institutions around the world and teaches a course in negotiations at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, right where my daughter lives. Hi, Kelly. And he joins us with his new book, Persuade, the Four-Step Process to Influence People and Decisions. Welcome to A New Direction for the first time, Andres Lars. Andres, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And I am now officially hiring you as my hype man for anywhere that I go. So please travel along with me. I definitely need that.
I'm not necessarily cheap, but yeah, I'll do that.
But you're worth it, though. Great
to have you on the show. I want to just jump right in here to the book because you do make a guarantee in this book. You say that we will stick with you throughout the course of this book, and here's what you say, and we promise, guarantee even, you'll become more persuasive. Mm-hmm. Why did you feel so confident about making that statement?
And that's actually part of the reason we wrote the book, I think, is because, at 10 seconds, if I step back for a moment, so sure. We are a negotiation and influence training company. Mm-hmm. And when we wrote, really, the negotiation came the opposite way. A book was written, and then kind of the course was built around the book. Influencing was the exact opposite. We have been doing influencing training for about 10 plus years, We had this model and we've been asked a few times and then did it. And so it was the experience of all those influence training sessions where there's not necessarily a ton of stuff where you're reading like, oh my goodness, I had never even thought of that. It's entirely new. But there's a lot of things, and I'd love your take on this, where when you read it, you realize, you ask yourself, do I do that on a consistent basis? Do I have a structure or a process to do that? And the answer is absolutely no for 99.9% of people. And so that's kind of where our confidence is that, you know, we may not blow your mind with something, but we will absolutely just about almost certainly make you better because we'll give you a structure that you can repeat.
And I am in that 99%. When I read this book, I went, you know, I think I'm good at that, but I'm really not as good as I'd like to think I am. Oh, well, there's something I forgot to do. You know, do I do this in the right order? Am I really doing this right? You know, or am I so focused on one area of it that I'm not really following through on the other steps as you move up the pyramid, which I found myself kind of kicking myself a little bit and going, oh man, you could do better. So let's talk about this four-step process of persuasion. There's four steps, and it is a pyramid. You kind of build on each level of this pyramid going up. So building credibility, engage emotions, demonstrate logic, and then facilitate action. And I want to just go ahead and start here in chapter two with building credibility. A lot of people are confused by credibility because when I ask the team, what does it mean to build credibility? I got a number of different answers, and I would say most of them were pretty much in there, but I think people will have their own perception of what credibility is. Help us understand when we say, okay, our first step is to build credibility, what are we really trying to do?
And I think, so even with everyone's kind of a bit of a different definition, it's one of those things like, I think I'll know it when I hear it. Mm-hmm. I think most people, when they think of credibility, they think of the right things around trust, mm-hmm. rapport, mm-hmm. relationship, mm-hmm. respect, right? And so if I have credibility in Jay's eyes, that means he respects my opinion. He trusts me. There's rapport build. There's a relationship there. But it can look very different. It can look very different depending on kind of the situation. So one example of credibility might be, for example, you know, there's a reason that Gatorade sponsors, you know, a lot of professional athletic events, right? Because if you look to the bench and they're drinking a Gatorade bottle, then there's credibility built there that there's, oh, okay, if the professional athletes are drinking Gatorade and it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me, right?
Sure.
But what's interesting about credibility is it expands really far. And we talked about this briefly in the book, but then you can take it further and say, well, you might have that same professional athlete say, this is the toothpaste I use. And what's incredible in credibility is it starts becoming illogical. A professional athlete is no better or worse at brushing their teeth than an average non-professional athlete, but it will transition over. That is the, you know, chosen toothpaste of a professional athlete. They likely will have credibility enough that it'll pass on that the people who respect that person, he or she, will then use that toothpaste, right, and kind of assume that transfers over. So, and there's some interesting studies on that, and some we cover in the book and some we don't. But so those are really at the core of credibility. There's that respect, trust, rapport, and really trust is the one we like the biggest of the person and their kind of their knowledge and capabilities.
Yeah, you used an equation here, credibility equals trust plus expertise. And I thought that was really quite interesting because I think about expertise quite a bit, and I can't disagree with trust, but expertise can be kind of a funny word here too, right? Because I think you make a point about it can't be just general expertise, correct?
Correct. And so, you know, that example, we take that toothpaste example that I just kind of made up, actually a very good one for this, right? And so if you look at that, if you look at commercial, the last commercial you can think of that you saw for a toothbrush or a toothpaste had someone either is a dentist or is dressed like a dentist. And so what happens is, you know, and they may say in very, very small letters that, you know, they're not a dentist, they're just acting. But what that's doing is that credibility, that expertise piece is being passed on even more so than the professional athlete example of toothpaste where, okay, I like the person, they're credible in my eyes, but they may not have specific expertise in the dental space. That's where kind of the lab coat or, you know, dentist attire will transition to that and be more powerful. And so there's trust in this case in kind of the certification process and schooling process that a dentist would go through in school. So they look like one, but there's also the expertise that's narrow, right? In particular, they're focused on dental hygiene. So that's why you're seeing them and you know, typically not a professional athlete or an actor necessarily recommending it, although it will transfer as much. So the more narrow and deep the expertise, the more powerful the credibility that's built.
Trust is a really dicey word, I think is a correct way of phrasing that, because there are people who will say, well, trust is earned, trust is, I'm one of those people who say, no, trust is something that you choose to give or you don't choose to give it. That's kind of my opinion. I don't know that anybody earns trust. I've used this with my college students in the past when I was teaching, and I would say, all right, give me all the list of everything I have to do to trust that will cause you to trust me, right? And so they'll give me this list, and then I will say, I will do all these things. Does that guarantee you'll trust me, or do you still make the choice of trusting me, right? And so that's where I kind of move in there. And you have four key components here, which I thought the equation was actually kind of cool. Connection plus value plus reliability, and I guess it's divided by self-interest, is the equation. Talk to us about building trust in these four key components.
Yeah, so if we go through each of those four, you know, connection is the most of the art and less of the science, and that like kind of that rapport that's mm-hmm. built. And that's why you talked to the beginning when we started today, kind of folks that say, you know, you might be a leader of a team or a CEO that says, look, our sales team isn't doing it. You know, just not able to get to the goals that we've set out for them. And there could be a lot of factors, obviously. But if you think about kind of, you sit on a call, any good salesperson builds rapport very quickly and say, oh, you know, Jay, how are you today? Where are you from? And what you're trying to do there is you're finding connection points. And the best salespeople and really the best leaders and most successful professionals in really any space tend to do this very naturally. Because what happens, two things are happening. One, they're able to build connection and find, oh, it turns out, for example, right before we started, we were talking about Cialdini, who is really kind of the godfather of influencing. And we both felt that way. And there's an immediate connection there. So number one is you just, that just happens naturally and that's great. But the second one is it's authentic. So, you know, in particular salespeople, but it's, you know, anyone who's good at it is able to kind of ask a few questions that'll help find connection points, but it's got to be authentic, because if it's not genuine and authentic, then people, it just feels wrong. And that's, if anything, actually, you know, destructive rather than, you know, giving. So that really, that connection's that intangible there. Now there are, we talk about it in the book and we train, is that there are some ways to make it more likely than not that some connections built, and certainly asking great questions that are driven by genuine curiosity is probably the most powerful, but that's really number one. You know, then number two, talk about value. And this is kind of an expertise where it's added to trust, that if I had no value whatsoever, it's hard for me to build trust, because it's not, I just become almost insignificant. And you think of it as, you know, the professional athletes with the largest endorsements are typically the ones that are performing the best, right? There's a reason I'm a Roger Federer fan. I love tennis. There's a reason Roger Federer, you know, Rolex wants him to sponsor rather than number 172nd in the world. And it just, so what happens is, you know, that there's that level of you know, expertise, if you will, but there's a level of value. And for a salesperson, that would be, you know, no one wants to be sold, right? And so there's a level of you delivering value, and then the customer then perceives that value, sees that value, and then buys, is much more effective. But that also means a procurement agent. Internally, a procurement agent has to be perceived as valuable within a company. Otherwise, the stakeholders just won't go to procurement, and they'll just bypass procurement. So that's kind of that piece of value. There has to be value delivered. Otherwise, you become insignificant. And then finally, the third, there's reliability. And really, this is the easiest by far to kind of turn around and start doing today that most people don't do. And this, you know, I think anyone can relate to, if you're to say, when someone says, hey, I'll give you a call back tomorrow, Jay. Now, what's the probability that person actually calls you back tomorrow professionally? Unbelievably, it's not as good as it should be. And so not only do you have to do what you say you're going to do, you should actually create, in a reasonable, authentic way, opportunities for you to do a little bit more of that. Right? If I was working on kind of building more rapport and this reliability meter with you, I would say, hey, I'll follow up a week after the podcast to kind of check in and see how things are going. And then 2 weeks later, we can chat about some of the things you had questions on in our addendum. And you create this cadence, and then I make sure I stick to that. And so that piece of reliability to the other party is really, really important. So that's the top half. I can go to the bottom half, but any thoughts on that?
Well, I think one of the things that you say here that I totally agree with is that the higher the value that someone perceives that you have, you're also moving the relationship into a higher trust level. So when we think about, and I would argue that the same is true for reliability. If I am doing what I say that I will do, right? Well, first of all, I would argue that it kind of actually increases my value because it does. But I would say that if I'm bringing more value to the table, right, that that perception, and I think that's what's really important, is the perception of value. What are they perceiving from you? Because I think we assume value quite frequently, especially if we're in that sales or negotiating position. I think we assume that we're bringing value, but it's not what we assume. It has to be what they perceive. And I think that's a critical, important factor in all of it.
I love that. And actually, when we talk about communications, what you just said is exactly the most important fact in communication. Is a lot of people are focused on what they say, what they're thinking. Okay, I'm thinking about something. I want to communicate this to Jay. And the part is really thinking about how I would like to communicate to Jay, and I want to be compelling and all these things. How much time do we spend on how is Jay going to receive this? And that means, like, you know, so for example, one of the things we might do in a session would be, have we thought about, you know, Jay and I have been communicating for 3 months, and I noticed that he sends me very long emails that are very well thought through and structured. Well, you know, that's probably not someone that I would send a quick 2-second note to, you know, that hasn't been thought through, that they're probably disciplined, organized. That's the way kind of their mind works. Or, you know, you might use the senses of everything might be like, I heard this, I heard that, and or I felt this, I felt that. There's some senses you might refer to. I might refer to those. Right? And so if you're thinking about being sensitive to what the other party is going to receive as much as what you're going to say, that's a whole different way to see communicating and much more impactful. It certainly values the exact same way, right? Like, and that really is emotional intelligence 101. Are you thinking enough about the other party? And the answer, and I can say this for myself and for anybody, is it's not enough. It's realistically probably not enough. And actually, that's a really good segue to then the kind of all that is above the line, and that's divided by really self-interest, right? And so this all comes down to, and I think it's, you know, easy for us to intuitively understand this, which is, do I feel like Jay has my self-interest or their own self-interest in mind at all, right? So his own or my interest. Now, of course, I am a salesperson and I'm trying to sell to Jay. Of course, and I can be very transparent about it. I have my sales goals and I have goals that I'm trying to achieve. But would I do anything it took to get the sale, or would I be willing to do and say some things where maybe it lowers the probability of the sale or the total value of the sale because I also want to make sure that Jay's satisfied? And that is one of the most powerful things, right? And so I, you know, and I think we've all heard the stories of where the person does that and a sale doesn't happen or it's smaller. And then, you know, they get referred 50 times over or whatever it may be. And so that piece of it is, of course, it is understandable to everyone to have your own self-interest in mind. But if that is entirely what you're thinking about and not the interest of the party at all, and not being willing to sacrifice anything for the other party's interests, then that's really going to be kind of the divider of what will likely diminish just about everything else you've done, the reliability, the value, and the connection that's been made.
I found it also interesting that you wove into this the nonverbal communication signals of trustworthiness, because I will say that we spend a lot of time in the sales process with verbiage, but we spend far less time in really training on what does your behavior say in those nonverbal areas. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit. I'm a big fan of Amy Cuddy and her research when she was at Harvard. I think she's now at Northeastern. But when she, you know, because she did the work on, before you get on the phone call, you know,
power pose.
Yeah, the power pose, make yourself big. And I mean, she demonstrated it clearly, right? Yeah. Talk a little bit about the nonverbal communication signals of trustworthiness.
Yeah, so I'd even almost take a layer back when I think of like nonverbal, or maybe not what you say, how you say it, even almost go bigger than just body language. Because, so Alvin Moravian has a UCLA professor came up with years ago a really interesting stat that I think there's probably some debate how accurate it is, but I think there's no debate that there's a significant point being made. And what he found that only 7% of what you're communicating is the words that you're saying. And then the other 93% is combination of the tone, how you say it, and your body language. And like I said, it's been some time since it's been redone, but really there's so much in really to take there. And so, and this would take us in so many avenues. But we talk a lot about, for example, think how different an experience is if I'm texting with someone, there's no tone. I call them on the phone, I can get a sense of the tone, whether that's being sarcastic or meaningful or not. Then whether I'm doing a video call where I get to see the person, which is one of the reasons I prefer this to just doing, you know, even if we can see each other, even if someone will just listen to the podcast, there's a better rapport and probably a better conversation to be had when you can see each other. And then, of course, there's no replication for being in person because there's just that touch and feel and shaking hands and maybe grabbing a coffee before or after and seeing what's really in the entire office and all those things. And all of that comes from all the all the information that's being communicated that's outside of just that, you know, the words that you say. And so then we take a step out of that, that piece of body language is super, super important. And he put it into the 60 plus percentile as far as how much was communicated. But whether that's exact or not, I think we can all agree. And the short answer for us on that is we struggle with how much to teach it because it can be misconstrued and it's so complex. But I think there's one thing we feel very confident about, which is what you're looking for is consistent patterns. If you and I are at a party and we're chatting or I'm in a business event, and if I were to just cross my arms like I'm doing now, that might signal I'm not interested, or that could also signal I'm cold, or that could also signal I'm uncomfortable with what I'm wearing, or whatever. It can be a lot of things. So to read, ooh, I read in this book that he crosses arms, he's probably not interested, I'm going to dramatically change the conversation, probably not ideal. But now what happens if I rotate away and now I'm 45 degrees to you? What happens if I'm looking away a little bit more, I minimize my eye contact and I do that? Well, now you've got multiple things pointing to the same direction. So yes, that means this person is uncomfortable what you're talking about, change the conversation, take a break, whatever it may be. And so that's really the biggest thing we talk about in body language is you're looking for consistency and you're trying to communicate consistency.
His name is Andres Lares. The book is called Persuade, the Four-Step Process to Influence People and Decisions. Beautiful light book, I guess kind of light blue, maybe it's kind of turquoise-ish blue with a black binder on the back. So I'm describing it so that when you're listening to this, you can go to the bookstore and purchase it. That's what I'm doing. Otherwise, what you could do is you just go to Amazon and get it as well. It's an absolutely fabulous book done by Wiley. You're listening to him here on A New Direction. Hey, folks, got a couple sponsors I need to talk about real quickly. Zoundy is one of them. I use Zoundy. It is an audiobook platform. And if you're an author, your publisher, who I know listen to the show quite a bit, or you're professional in the audiobook space, Zoundy is fantastic. What's different about Zoundy than any other audio platform is that I actually know who downloads my book and I can interact with the people who actually listen to it. And that has made just such a difference in asking them what they like, what they didn't like, what I could write next, how I can improve, what I could do. And also, you know, just have discussions about what they read in the book, and I found it so valuable. I have a special offer right here on A New Direction. Just go to zoundy.com, zoundy.com/J. Use my code JAY25. That's JAY25. And you'll unlock special savings on Zoundy. Check them out. They're really awesome. And Linda Craft Team Realtors, for more than 40 years, they've helped people transition in life. And you go to real estate, how do they help people transition in life? It's pretty easy. Every place that you've ever lived has been a life transition, right? Well, they know how to take the stress out of that. And that's what they've done so well for 40 plus years. They'd love to help you. They've helped people all over the world, thousands. So check them out, lindacraft.com, LINDACRAFT.com. And we're back here on A New Direction with Andres Lares and the book, Persuade, the Four-Step Process to Influence People and Decisions. We're talking about credibility, the first stage to persuade and influence others. And I don't want to quite get out of there yet before we move on to the emotions part, engaging emotions. I want to talk about the liking effect real quick. I have said in front of audiences when I've spoke at conferences that, you know, we don't give money to people we don't trust. We don't trust people we don't like, and we don't like people we don't know. And there seems to be this way of going. And I have said that one of the fastest way to trust is through likability. And you talk about the reciprocity of liking, which I think is part of that. Mm-hmm. And you also go into the four components of building trust, and then I think kind of falls in there. Let's talk about the focus on building. Well, we talked about the three kind of building connection, be reliable, provide value, be selfless. Let's talk about the reciprocity of liking here a little bit, and why that's so important to maybe building trust and enhancing our credibility.
I think this one's, you know, short but sweet, because I think exactly what you said in your sessions is what we would say, in that people like to do business with people who they like and who are like them. right? And so it's just those two things. And so who they like means that connection's built. That's referring to that connection component where you want to find those similarities of people. And that makes sense, right? It's a heuristic that, like, I can let my guard down because Jay is more similar to me. It might be because we both train people, salespeople, or it might be because we both like the same sports team, or because we both enjoy growing flowers, whatever it could be. Find those connection points is important. And, you know, it's that combination of if you're like them, that is certainly one factor that's going to help you like them. And once that connection's made, you're much more likely to do business with them. And so it is, you know, as much as we like to think we make logical decisions, that is certainly a factor. And we are not completely logical beings. So that kind of comes into play often.
Well, I think, Andres, you know, if I like you, right, if I just find you that I go, you know, he's a good guy, right? I just, whatever the reason is, because it's not necessarily has to be logical, right? It could just be.
It's often not, you know, like you said one thing that I liked, or I like this friend, or we play baseball together, whatever. It could be anything. You know, we sat beside each other at a game or something, but it is often not logical, but it is powerful. That piece of emotion, which we're going to get to, is it's amazing how powerful it is, because if I were to ask you, Jay, why do you like Andres? Yep. You may have struggled. You may struggle to find a specific reason, but you know, you feel it.
Yes.
And so it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do. I do like you. So I know we haven't talked about that, but I do. I do find you very likable. I enjoy you. I don't want to.
I haven't gone long enough. We'll check in at the 50th minute mark.
Well, we've had 20 some odd minutes together. I feel pretty confident in that. You've done the one thing about this book is you've done the three of you have done a great deal of research in this book, and you have at the end of this section the evidence from decision makers on credibility, and I found the top five results to be quite interesting, because I don't know that we would assume that the most significant, I would call them the most significant, the top five were probably something that people would necessarily think of. And it kind of, the top one was someone you feel that you work well with, which I think lends itself to likability. But then the second one was they're approachable and easy to talk to. Well, so far, Andres, you're two for two.
Fingers crossed.
Have the endorsement of experts in their industry. Okay, you're three for three. Customer reviews on their website, company website, 4 for 4. And they are someone you feel you would like, you know, that you would just like. And again, that likability piece seems to be very, very prominent, because I don't think you're going to get customer reviews if people don't like you. Endorsement from experts. Okay, I think that lends itself to the expertise probably a little bit. Mm-hmm. But there's two of the five are someone that you feel that you would either work well with or that you would like. That's interesting to me. Did it fascinate you guys when you saw those five at the end?
I think we knew we'd find it because we've been teaching it, but I think we were surprised. Like the two things that it was, the one was being high was probably not surprising. The two being in the top five, I think is where you see it, right? You'd expect some combination of, you know, again, it goes to that trust equation. There's going to be some value. So the fact that experts are, you know, referring to you or are kind of pointing towards you, okay, that's value and credibility. And equally, you've got case studies or testimonials or whatever, maybe from clients. That's almost a little bit of social proof. Mm-hmm. We should talk about. So those make sense. And I think anyone intuitively knows that. But it's interesting. And so I think that's, you know, I remember when we first started kind of playing around with these conclusions and doing our preliminary research like 10 years ago, that changed the way we ended up doing our website even, right? Which is at the beginning, it's easy for you to build something where it's entirely based on, here's, you know, some testimonials, some case studies, and that's it. And it turns out that, you know, the colors you choose and the profiles, for example, we have very, you know, the bios and personal profiles are very top, kind of front, you know, right there in your face. And the reason we do that is to kind of personalize it for exactly that reason. That there's a time and place for the case studies and the video testimonials that give you that credibility, but there's also, and this is, I don't think we talked too much about this in the book, but it's incredible. When we did the research, there's so much stuff that doesn't make it in the book, which is equally as interesting. So it's hard to put it all in. But one of this is incredible is there's a few studies that have been able to predict who wins elections at a local level, a municipal level, and even at a state level, based on a 3-second visual of all the candidates. So, and I'm going to butcher this, but I'm not going to be far. There's one that we were that may have been very briefly referenced, but if not, certainly I dove into a lot. It was in the high 60s, the percent of probability of being able to predict who would win an election. And that was literally, you look at the face of someone and then they would answer who's going to win. And then they did a couple of tiers where they say, okay, how likable is the person? And there was a perfect correlation, how likable they are to how likely they thought they were going to win the election. And then there was a 68% prediction, which is pretty darn good, right? If you're an odds maker, you could be making a good amount of money in all these betting sites if you have that in advance. And so that's based on not anything platform related, what their views are, their name, nothing. I mean, there's like absolutely only looking at someone's face. So not only is it likability, but think how quickly, 3 seconds, and then they even redid it with like 1 second, like a quick glimpse, and that was pretty close. Well, so, I mean, we digress, but I think it's really important to think that likability goes back to what I said, it is absolutely not logical, it happens very quickly, and it is very powerful.
Well, wasn't it Thorndike, the halo effect? Didn't he move into the halo effect?
The halo effect is, yeah.
Right? Wasn't it? I think it was Thorndike that was kind of moving in that direction, right? Because, I mean, we kind of, you know, if we see somebody attractive or that we kind of are attracted to, right, we're going to give them more credibility, you know, and more credit. We think they're smarter, right? I've seen this study done with taller people, right?
Yeah. Well, look at CEOs, average height of CEOs.
Right.
They're not the average height of people, I can tell you that. I believe Fortune 500 CEOs average height is like 6'4", 6'5".
Yeah.
I mean, that is massive.
Right. Well, I'm thank God I'm tall because I'm not that smart. So so I'm feeling pretty good about myself there. I do want to say that you did spend a lot of time on borrowing credibility, and I brought this up with my team yesterday about borrowing credibility. I think it's really important that we talk about that just for a second, because I think borrowing credibility is very, very important because of the association fallacy that we tend to make in psychology. Talk about that briefly, about borrowing credibility.
Yeah, I just think of it as, sometimes we don't have credibility because we're just starting out. It's a new industry for us, or people don't know us. And so borrowing credibility is, as critical as you've got to find in your sphere. And so it's that example of, for example, an author comes out with a new book, and you'll see that the testimonials, are typically in the back cover or the inside cover, whatever it be, and they're typically, kind of known people. And so what they're saying is, look, you may not know Andres, but you certainly do know these people. And we were no different, right? We reached out to folks that were fans. We sent them a copy of the book, and then we chose a few people. And the thinking was, hey, you may not know who Andres Lattice is, Jeff Cochran, and, Sean, who did help us do a lot of the research. But you certainly then, if you know any of these other people and they say good things, and so that's really what that borrowing credibility of is, it's a kind of a combination of the social proof. But that is a perfect example of something that you can, are we systematic with that, right? Mm-hmm. Borrowing credibility is not this novel thing that no listener has thought about. I mean, that's absolutely not the case. Mm-hmm. But how often have we thought about, okay, I'm trying to influence Jay. Who am I going to borrow credibility from if I don't have credibility yet with Jay? Mm-hmm. So who's a colleague that he knows and likes and trusts that can be in that first meeting when I pitch an idea? Or that I could say, I ran it by X and Y person, and that's going to help Jay consider it more. Have we done that, and do we do that systematically? That's kind of a perfect example when we talk about improving results by being systematic. And, that borrowing credibility is a perfect example of it.
I love that. I matter of fact, I was talking to the team about, it's a big brand that's been around for decades, and, new agents come in, and I was talking about this with the real estate team that I was working with, and I said to the new agent, I said, do you realize you're borrowing credibility because this brand is so big? So as soon as you join the team, you're already starting to borrow credibility. Even though you don't feel like you have a lot of experience, mm-hmm. you're borrowing credibility by being a part of this brand. Mm-hmm. Boy, you could see their face change because they go, oh, I never thought about that. You've got credit. You already got credibility. You've been selected to be part of this sales team. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting thing, and something that we got to pay attention to. I just thought it was genius. Let's move right into the second tier, engaging emotion. We're not logical beings, Andres. In fact, we are terribly illogical. Dan Ariely and I, who are connected in LinkedIn, who I have a lot of respect for, who wrote the book Predictably Irrational. Fabulous book. Really smart guy. Just demonstrates over and over again that we do not make logical decisions. Every decision is an emotional one. Dig into that a little bit more.
And that's certainly what Aristotle found. So another example of Bohrian credibility that's very authentic is that, you know, the model, the four-step model we're talking about now is ours, right? But it is based on the three-step model that Aristotle came up with in 350 BC. And so, you know, that's an example of some people listening to you and I today, you know, may not be sure if we know what we're talking about. There's a certain level of respect for Aristotle that helps. And he had ethos, pathos, logos, which is credibility, emotion, and logic. And so that's really what this comes from. And Ariely's research was really kind of furthering that, if you think all the examples where we make irrational decisions. And I think that's not surprising in that there's just biases, right? So I think a combination of that book and Thinking Fast and Slow do a great job in kind of talking about, you know, really the brain is lazy, right? And it is trying to minimize its work and its output. Or not necessarily output, but at least the work and the effort put in. And so because of that, it takes shortcuts. And those shortcuts are what keep us alive, right? It's like you jump accidentally into the lion's den in a zoo or something. And it's what, you know, if you see a gun, you run or whatever it may be, right? There's a kind of a natural inclination to do things and the fight or flight and all these things that naturally through evolution we're hardwired to do. And the irrationality comes with that. And these shortcuts essentially have all the situations where we might mess up because we don't have enough information and we make bad decisions. And so the halo effect is one. Someone's good looking, we're more likely to think they're going to be successful, we're more likely to hire them, but that really has zero correlation to them actually being, you know, smarter or more emotionally intelligent or more disciplined or harder working or anything else. And so there's just so many biases. I mean, we actually thought about including like a very long list of biases in our book, and that would have been like a third of the book. So we kind of just mentioned a few. And so I think the irrationality is there. And so I think the best line that we kind of came out with in this book that comes from Aristotle's thinking is that people make decisions emotionally and then they justify them rationally.
Yeah.
I think that's really how to kind of sum this all up is we could all agree, make them emotionally, but then there has to be a justification, right? We sit down, we go to bed at night, we have to talk to our boss or our peer, and we have to justify the decision. And we're going to point to, you know, the data, the stats, the store, whatever it may be, but we most likely made that decision at least partially emotionally.
So agree. And you move on to I would call them almost two emotional, I don't know if it's needs, I don't know if that's the correct phrasing I want to use, but there's two emotional areas for sure that people, that we use and influence, whether you should be intentional about it, but it's the people's need for achievement. And then it's the people's desire to escape from fear, which are two very powerful elements that we maybe don't use in our ability to influence people. Talk about why those two are specifically so powerful.
And I probably, you know, there's a third probably obligation that's probably
obligation.
So, you know, achievement, you know, this is an example. And again, you know, this is, will sound a little bit boiler room, but there's a lot of sales teams where, you know, you have kind of everyone's sales information and revenue for the month, and it's all posted on a board and it's competitive. And the competition is a part of it, but it's the achievement where if you're the number one seller that month, you know, or if you're the number one seller that year, you're part of kind of the annual sales trip that they all take. And the trip is nice. You go to the Bahamas or you go to Charleston or you know, golfing or whatever it may be. But it's also the achievement where for yourself and to your peers, it kind of sets you in the kind of the cream of the crop, if you will. And so there's that feeling like of success that comes from the feeling of achievement that comes from not only you being in the top, but also your peers being aware of it. And so that's one for sure. And so this can be framed in a way where, you know, if Jay's ambitious and has – you know, high goals, how does this help you get there? That's kind of the, what I would call the carrot, right? The flip side is, and fear is the stick. And so this might be, you're in a complex sales situation and you're talking to someone and, you know, oftentimes you'll say, oh, these are all the benefits. And I'll talk about all the benefits. And if I'm a good salesperson, I'll tie it to your business, which is great. So it's not just kind of advantages and features, But really, then part of it is, well, what about the other side? You know, Jay, what would happen if you don't do this, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm a CRM company and you don't have a CRM, and so your data is everywhere and disorganized, it's not what the cost of a CRM system is. What's the cost of not having one, your competitors mm-hmm. having one? What's the cost of not organizing your data and not even knowing how many sales have slipped through the cracks or whatever it may be? Mm-hmm. And that's the stick, right? That's the fear piece of it. And that's also the scarcity, right? Every infomercial that, you know, if you buy now in the next 30 seconds, it's four easy payments of $19.99. That's scarcity that you feel like this deal is going to go away. And the last one I'd say is obligation, which is also very powerful, which is really about, you know, and I like this example, even though it's personal, not business, which is, you know, we're neighbors and Jay, you invite me over and you ask me, do you mind helping me move, you know, my furniture, and I'm happy to do it. And then I realized right then and there that, you know, I need a little bit of help with my deck tomorrow. You know, the best time to ask for something is, you know, right when you've given something and there, that reciprocity comes there because there's that sense of obligation. You know, I just helped Jay out. Jay's going to feel compelled to help me out. And so the obligation to be either reciprocity or just feels right or, to do the right thing. So obligation can also be a powerful one along with fear and achievement.
I think in the sales process, the achievement piece is, you know, like if I this is really what stood out to me is if I'm selling something, is knowing what will give that person that is potentially going to be my client, what is it that will give them the sense of achievement, right? And being able to deliver that in whatever I'm selling, right? I'm a little bit softer on fear in that I'm probably more of a FOMO guy in that, you know, well, if you don't do this, here's what might happen, you know, by not making this decision is where I go. And obligation, of course, the law of reciprocity is the law of reciprocity. It's been with us for centuries, but it's true. And research has demonstrated it. And you know this, that you can give something small to somebody, and they will want to give you far more back in return. It just works that way. We're coming up to a Christmas holiday here. If you've ever had a Christmas list, right? And, you know, you're looking at all the people you got to buy presents for, right? And you go, yeah, you know, I haven't talked to this person in, you know, probably 2 years. You know, I'm going to take them off the list. And then they show up your door with a little box saying, hey, I just want to say Merry Christmas. And you took them off your list. And you go back, right? And you know, you say thank you and you're feeling a little sheepish because you don't have anything to give them. And you go back and you open it up and it's maybe a little trinket or something not real big. But what do? You go out and you buy them a bottle of Dom Perignon and show them up at the door, right? Right? Because that's the reciprocity. I think those are the things, the little things like that, I think are so influential.
I'm going to need your address because I do want to drop out with a little trinket or something.
That could be a good investment. Right. But I mean, it is those little things in the sales process that you should be thinking of. What do they need to achieve? What would be the results if they don't make the decision? Right. And then what have you given them that they would want to give back? I think that's right. I think that's all part of pulling all that together. Or did I miss that? I think I got it right.
No, I love it. And we say, like, what's the win for them? It's exactly what you said. What's the win for them, right? And the win is perceived and real. And that's in everything. I mean, we advise, as you said earlier, sports teams on player contract negotiation trades. And oftentimes we are working through what's the win for the other team, even if it's publicly. How do we make the other general manager look good? And as much as we talk about, you know, logically that their job isn't to necessarily look good, but looking good is important because they got to look good to their owner to keep their job. They got to look good to potentially have credibility in the space to be able to make other trades, right? So that's that happens in everything. It happens in sports, sales, you know, leadership, in just about every place. So you've got to be thinking about how do you give the win to the other party.
His name is Andres Lares. The book is titled Persuade, the Four-Step Process to Influence People and Decisions. Absolutely outstanding. Find it everywhere. If your local bookstore doesn't have it, you tell them to get it on the shelf because it's going to sell. It's pretty darn awesome. I love it. You're listening to him here on A New Direction. Hey, folks, real quickly, my sponsors, got to give them a shout out. Zoundy. If you're in the audiobook space, publishers, authors, professionals, best audiobook platform I've ever been involved with. I'm involved with a couple. Got a special offer. What I love about them is I can reach out to the people who actually download the book and communicate with them. It's fantastic. Check out my special code, Zoundy.com, Zoundy.com/J, J-A-Y. Use my code, J-A-Y-2-5. That's J-A-Y-2-5. You'll unlock special savings. Linda Craft Team Realtors. I'm biased, but I think it's the best real estate website in the land. The reason why, yeah, they have all the listings and everything else that you could ever want to see. And, you know, they got vendors of, you know, who they've worked with and who they recommend and that type of thing right there on the website. What I love about them, though, is they interviewed a child psychologist on how to move with children. They've interviewed a veterinarian how to move with pets. Just so complete with information. They do this great podcast called Real Estate Right Now, talking about real estate matters that matter to you with people live in the studio. Check them out, lindacraft.com, LindaCraft.com. And we're back here on A New Direction with my friend. Well, he doesn't know we're friends yet, but we are. Andres Lara's the book, Persuade, the four-step process to influencing people in decisions. I'm having a great time doing it. I can't speak for Andres, but I'm having a fantastic time.
not too shabby for me.
But before we get, before we leave the emotional piece, a couple things. One is anaphora that... or maybe I mispronounced it. Is it anaphora? Anaphora?
Anaphora, I think.
Is it anaphora?
I think so.
People, this is a concept that people very rarely hear of, but it's really, and it kind of, you kind of put it in the book a little bit, and it's kind of hidden if you're not reading the book really carefully. Talk about what that is and how it fits into the rhythm of the script.
So, I mean, that's cadence, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's I think this kind of came in, and I think we talk about it in particular, kind of the, you know, famous speeches, if you think about it. And so Martin Luther King's speech is particular, we talk about it. And so that actually made it, if we talk about that, focus there for a minute. There's a chapter where we kind of talk about another thing called Kairos, and mm-hmm. it's a time and place. And this doesn't make the model because... It's a little harder to use practically and a little bit more complex, but it's certainly noteworthy, and this is a perfect time to chat about it, which is, so if you look at the, you know, the Martin Luther King speech, it actually had been done before. So he had done that speech before, and he had done it in other places. And so Kairos, really the time and the place and kind of like seizing the opportunity, that concept really catches it. And so that's one of them, which is like the time was at that point, really, you know, there was a lot going on in the country where it really made an impactful speech. The place really where it was done could not have been more significant. And then the, in particular, him as an orator and why speeches by him or, you know, sometimes, you know, unrelated to politics, you know, Obama's considered to be a great orator. There's these folks, you know, Winston Churchill, there's folks where they have very famous speeches. And I think that's really why there's a cadence with which they speak that you can train as much as you want. I think a good chunk of that is natural. Mm. And then some of it is trained, but I think a good chunk of that is natural, right? It's like the pauses and they just have you, if you think of like those, the best presenters in the world, not only have a cadence, but they kind of have you sitting at the front of your chair waiting for, you know, at every word. And that's really where that comes from. And the signs of it, we talk a little bit, which is kind of what you mentioned. And that's, you know, there's a cadence that if you write speeches in a certain way, it can be more or less compelling, and that's true, but I find that very difficult. Like, it just takes so much practice, and then to be able to execute that under the pressures of a, you know, a big speech or a big TV interview or a job interview or something, it can be hard, but there's certainly a lot to it and a lot of science to support that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's some natural, ability there. I will say, though, that I do also agree that in order to do that, you have to practice, and then edit, practice. Because I remember Jerry Seinfeld saying something, how he would take a joke and just work on it over and over before he would even try it, because mm-hmm. there had to be a cadence to it, there had to be a rhythm to it, there had to be a timing to it. And now listen, not everybody can be Jerry Seinfeld and be that funny, but I mean, so there is some natural ability there, right? I mean, there's just some raw talent there, but then there is also the execution of the practice of doing that. And I think that's the thing when it comes to sales that I find very practical is, you know, rehearse, practice, you know, work on those little details. What is your cadence like? You know, what does it sound like? Those things are often missed in those sales opportunities because sometimes you're so well scripted, you're too well scripted, and it doesn't come out naturally, and it comes out wrong, and you've got to readjust your cadence because what you've done is you just ran right over your potential client because you've not really paid attention to your cadence. That's what I found important about it. Maybe I overthought it a little
bit. No, I like it. I think for definitional purposes to make sure we get it right, I think the anaphora, so that's covered in the chapter in Kairos, and we talk about the speeches, but anaphora, I think in particular, also has in it a lot about kind of the repetition. And so I think politicians do this, salespeople and politicians are the two that do this the most, right? Mm-hmm. In sales, there's the quote of, you know, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them, right? Is a very common phrase that in sales training appears. And then politicians, the same thing, right? It's like you just keep on, going to the same message, and it'll be, you know, if you kind of say it enough, people will believe it to be true. And so I think repetition is a big part of that. And so, you know, just to be kind of accurate, but I think we've covered a little bit more than that. And I think that combination is really important, the repetition, and which is really, really powerful. And then the cadence is that, you know, that combination, the 1-2 punch, but this is kind of more in the more advanced, complex aspects to be able to implement.
Yeah. I'm going to spend just a few couple minutes here because I want people to read the rest of the book on demonstrating logic. So I'm going to ask the question that you ask in the first sentence of chapter 4. Why is demonstrating logic important when most people rely on their emotions to make decisions?
Well, we spend a little less time on this than we spend on others because this one's a little bit more natural to folks. But there is countless ways where logic is communicated in a way that's just simply not compelling. And that's really so. This is the most natural. People are not naturally thinking about what logic, what emotion to kind of engage and what emotional levers to pull in order to influence people. They're typically already thinking about what logic to use. So that part isn't a mind shift, but it's either you don't say enough, and so it's an incomplete picture. You say too much, and so you get bogged down in the details, and so people just stop caring, right? It's, if you say so much, then the impact of whatever you said is lessened. You know, and so then you get into best practice, like, for example, story. And so one of the things we talk about in the book there for sure is, can you tell a compelling story that will communicate that message rather than the data, right? Can you replace the two charts in one graph, those three slides, with one brief story that captures the key pieces of data that you want to communicate? And certainly the latter will be, you know, more impactful than the former. So there's a time and a place for it, and there's already, if you're already following emotion, that's important. But there's certainly ways to be more compelling and more succinct, and that's really what we try to get out of that chapter.
Yeah, we've done an hour, and I would love for us to continue, but I know you've got time, and if you ever want to come back in the show, I'd love to have you come back in the show and discuss more of this because I really enjoy this as well. I do want to just say, it just in a brief second here, I do find that, you know, there is a logical process that we do go through, justification when we make a purchase or whatever we do or why we do what we do. But we do bring in our own set of biases into it. Anchoring is, of course, an important piece of that process. Is there some other little piece of summary when it comes to using logic in this sales process that just really stands out to you?
That's another one. I like that you bring up logic, and I would say that I think that's a very good one to, you know, kind of end on, if you will, and really think about, because one of the things that we found when we did our studies and they're first in the book is that anchoring is so powerful, it can be totally unrelated. Mm-hmm. If I ask you, how old is your grandparent, and then you give me that age, unbelievably, that will likely impact, if I ask you another question, completely unrelated, as what's the weather, you know, what do you think the weather will be tomorrow? And it's incredible. So we had a couple of those, and, you know, they're in the book. And so I think anchoring is very much real, and it's absolutely real in, you know, specifically, for example, when you're negotiating, if I make the first offer and that anchors, that it's also turns out there's lots of data indicated. It goes beyond even very tangential and even related terms. And so I think, you know, it's a really important concept to think about, because both, you want to use it to your advantage. You also want to be thoughtful about when you're being anchored, right?
Yeah.
growing. And if you're thinking about like, oh yeah, I always thought that was 50. Well, why do you think that? And you start to think about, well, that's because someone else said this. Then you can take a step back and say, let's just completely forget about why I thought that and start from scratch and figure out what the right number is for whatever maybe you're doing.
You've been fabulous. Thank you so much for doing this with me today. How can people get a hold of you? What's the best way for them? They go, I got to get into the Shapiro Negotiations Institute. I need to do this. What do I do?
Thank you. Well, thank you for your questions today and for having me. And so it's probably the best two places I can think of are certainly our website. So ShapiroNegotiations.com. And then number two is LinkedIn. That's kind of where we post the most. We're mainly a B2B company focused offering. And so really those are the two best places to find us. But it's been a pleasure, and I hope people enjoyed it, both wherever they're listening.
Well, we had a bunch of people watching, so everybody who's watching, thank you for watching us live, and for those of you listening to the show, thank you so much. Andres, thank you so much. Stay with me, please. Hey, folks, this is the show. You know what I say to you every week? You're in control of three things: your attitude, your effort, and your resiliency. Life doesn't always give us what we want. We don't always choose the circumstances that we're in, but you do have a choice in your attitude. Choose your attitude. Make it a positive one, because that's your choice. Second, your effort is tied to your excellence, and you choose that every day. So how much effort do you give today? I know you may not have the same amount of energy in your tank today, but you still choose how much of that effort you're going to use. Be excellent. That's your choice. And then finally, we all get punched in the gut, punched in the teeth, and get knocked down, but it's our choice to get back up. And choose to get back up. Why? Because you're worth it, and we need you on the team. You know what? You had a lot of choices. You chose us. I thank you for doing that. Give us a thumbs up on YouTube, wherever you're listening to the show. Give us a 5-star review. Subscribe. It's pretty easy. Just hit that little subscribe button wherever you're at. We appreciate that as well. As I say to you all over the world, I thank you so much. I'm so grateful. And ciao, everybody.
Things are gonna change. You can't find the strength to go a different way. Yeah. The time has come. Your dreams will take you places you have never been before. Find your passion, find your strength. Don't worry anymore. A new direction.